So I'm double mic'd because there's a couple flies on the wall back there for the first couple minutes. They're doing a documentary on low-carbon keto, and that's kind of what I'm talking about to some degree. Any of you guys heard about it or know it or have used it? How many of you guys have lost like 10 pounds or more doing low-carb keto? No, so you've heard about it more than doing it. Yeah, I know this guy's unbelievable, man. So that's kind of, you know, as a doc, this is a topic. If you would ask me a year ago if I'd be talking to you guys right now about this, I would have lost every dime in my bank account because there's no way I want to talk about this subject because I'm not an expert in addiction. So us medical guys, I'm an internal medicine doc. I've been in practice since 2003. For most of that time, I gave bad advice nutritionally because I gave the standard of care. And the standard of care is not great right now. We're finding out. I'm not an expert in addiction, but every day we deal with addiction. We deal with alcohol, drugs, smoking, and all this stuff. And you start thinking, gosh, why are we such an addicted society now compared to where we were when I was a kid? We didn't see so much of this stuff. Maybe we didn't talk about it as much. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have all this fancy stuff. So this is not medical advice. Talk to your doc. Make sure I always have to say that whenever I give a talk. And I'm not being paid in any way for this talk, but if you guys can pull some strings with the Hoffman, maybe down the road they'll pay me a nickel or something. So is it possible that food could be an addiction? And what is it about this low-carbon keto stuff that everyone's starting to hear about? Is it healthy? Is it not healthy? And, you know, I think it's determining what works for you, right, ultimately. Some of us are going to have a struggle with food. I've struggled with obesity my entire life, so when I started doing low-carb, I started seeing results for the first time. I was working out 6 days a week, doing everything right. I was drinking green shakes, and I was doing all this stuff. And I was like, why am I not losing weight? I'm doing the right stuff. But when you start realizing the physiology of what's happening in our bodies, it makes it that much clearer. And the biggest surprise for me was this was historically used. This is not a new fad. You're going to hear it all the time. This is a fad. It's crazy. It's going away. Osler, the godfather of medicine, when someone had diabetes, he would put them in the hospital and cut their carbs down until they weren't peeing out sugar anymore. And then they said, okay, this is the amount of carbohydrate you eat. We use it for seizure disorder. Still, I mean, I don't know. Has anyone heard of my podcast, Low Carb MD? So I know you know all this stuff. So this was a surprise. We have a lady with seizure disorder. This is where you say, gosh, the standard of care is crazy. Her story is worth listening to if you ever have a chance. Seizure disorder. She's on 5 medicine to control her seizures. She goes to her doctor 5 times and says, what do you think about keto, low carb for seizure disorder, which is the historical use for this kind of diet? It stabilizes the neurotransmitter, stabilizes seizures. She said, no, it's too dangerous. Don't do it. It's too restrictive. You'll never do it. So instead what they did, they mapped her brain. They were going to take out part of her temporal lobe as a cure for her seizures that were intractable. They were menstrual related. So whenever she had her period, for a week after that, she'd be miserable with seizures. So her whole life was destroyed. She got over 300 pounds and said, you know what? I'm not getting my brain cut on. I'm going to try the keto diet on herself. 6 months later, she goes to her doctors, 0 seizures in 6 months. The doctor says, oh, good, the medicine's finally working. She said, I'm off all my medicines, right? Doctor got super mad at her, said, that's irresponsible and crazy. Now, 3 years later, she weighs 138 pounds. She's lost 200 pounds. That's a side effect, but she hasn't had seizures. So I asked her, I said, how often do you cheat on the keto diet? She said, never, because I can't run the risk of having a seizure again. So clearly it has some neurotransmitter, some kind of mental effect and our brain, because I went in it because of obesity and diabetes. We see this devastation of diabetes. I've seen legs amputated, dialysis. All of us have seen that in family members, friends, and all that kind of stuff. So I became more passionate about it from that standpoint. And then I understood the importance of hormone balance. This is what is a struggle. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Rob Seifus because it's really important to understand his concepts. But my wife, everyone knows my wife. She's the principal at the middle school. Super calm, super easy going. Sometimes she's emotional and stressed about it. I go, why is she freaking out about this dumb stuff, right? The next day she said, oh, my period started. I knew what it was. But that's the hormones getting crazy and going up and down. And us guys have the same thing, especially because we have counter-regulatory hormones. And I'll talk a little. I don't want to get too scientific, but if you guys want to, if we have a few minutes at the end, we'll do that just for the sake of time. My greatest surprise really is seeing this. They're shooting a documentary. They had 5 of my patients yesterday. And the biggest shock, people resolve PTSD. People resolve anxiety, depression, schizophrenia. And it's shocking, because we weren't treating them for that. We're treating them for their sugars and their diabetes and obesity. And these things are a side effect of what we're seeing, just with some simple dietary changes. So we got into this messy topic, and this is going to apply to some guys here. And this is the thing I thought I would never, ever, ever think about talking about. Troy Kalajian is my partner on the podcast. He's a hothead. He's a super smart guy. He's lost 150 pounds doing low carb. And his practice primarily now is obesity medicine, diabetes. He's board certified in obesity medicine. So here's his tweet to me. This guy just throws me under the bus, right? He goes, Brian, I've had 10 guys in my practice say that they stopped pornography. They were addicted to pornography before they stopped it. 10 guys, out of the blue. I don't even talk to my patients about this stuff. So he said they're not addicted to that. Their erections are better. They're having more sex with their partner, and they're not doing pornography anymore, and their testosterone went up. Well, we know estrogen is fat tissue has a lot of estrogen. As we lose fat tissue, our testosterone naturally goes up. So he says, Brian, what do you think about this? Kind of weird. And this is a public forum, right? So I go, hey, Tro, it's kind of interesting what you're talking about. Maybe it's because they lose that craving for carbs, right? And maybe when we eat carbs, a lot of us who have food addictions, it's because we're stressed out, tense, and we're stress eaters, right? Insulin levels go up, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But I said, maybe their sex drive is improving because their testosterone, their performance is better because their testosterone is going up. Self-esteem's better, so they don't feel like they're embarrassed to be unclothed in front of their partner. So it's kind of interesting they're doing that instead of porn. And then this guy pipes in, Carnivore Cruz, and he says, you know what, guys? I was going to post on this. I'm glad you guys brought it up. And I didn't want to post on this topic, right? I didn't want to really get into this. And so he says, yeah, that's it. After this, 50 people said, look, I gave up alcohol. I gave up smoking. I gave up drug. I gave up excessive shopping. Because the crazy connection is this. When we're stressed out and tense, what do? Right? Some of us turn to food. Some turn to alcohol. Some turn to cocaine. Some turn to this. And so when you start looking at it, another guy posted a video, same thing. He quit alcohol after years of struggling and going through all this stuff. And I want to tell his story a little bit more later. But so Rob Seifus is there, a bariatric surgeon, and I have him on the podcast. It's actually episode number 10. Anyone struggling with weight or addiction, I would definitely recommend listening to him. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. But we got into a discussion. He goes, Brian, there's two food groups. There's fat and there's protein. Then he starts talking. I said, wait, Rob, go back. Doc, there's carbohydrates also. He goes, nah, not a food, it's a drug. I said, well, not a drug, it's a food. And he goes, no, it's a drug. Why do you say it's a drug? Well, because you don't need it in your life. You can go your whole life without carbohydrates and survive. You're going to get carbohydrates from vegetables and fruits, things like that. But you don't have to have processed food and all this kind of stuff. And so I said, well, I don't know if it's an addiction necessarily. He goes, okay, put it this way. You go to an all-you-can-eat steakhouse. You eat steak all night and you're stuffed and you can't take another bite. They put another steak in front of you. What do you say? I'm done. Give it to someone else. Give me a doggy bag, right? And he says, instead of a steak, they put your favorite dessert in front of you. Then you say, oh, I can have a bite of that. Okay? So you do, and then all of a sudden your dessert's gone and you eat the whole thing. Even though your body is telling you, don't eat anymore, you're stuffed. You've had enough nutrition. You don't need any more. But we do it. And he says, it's because of the dopamine release. When you eat sugary foods, when you eat this thing, you get dopamine released, just like you would with cocaine, just like you would with all this other stuff. I said, well, Rob, there's a social aspect. People like to have desserts. We like to have a donut together. We like to do stuff. And he says, well, Brian, when's the last time you craved a cigarette? I said, I don't crave cigarettes. I never smoked. And he says, once if you smoked for 20 years and you quit cigarettes yesterday, what's the first thing you're going to think about when you wake up and the last thing before you go to bed? Cigarettes. If you find a cigarette butt somewhere, you're going to pick it up and smoke it. You don't care if you catch a disease at that point, right? So it's that kind of thing. When we're quitting stuff, it's so difficult. And I said, well, Rob, you're kind of hardcore on this addiction part of it. And I said, why are you so adamant about it? And he says, Brian, because I'm a carb addict. He lost 90 pounds himself. He was going to get gastric bypass. He's a gastric bypass surgeon. He was going to get bypass himself and said, if I could lose weight on my own, I'll do it. He lost 90 pounds, but 3 times after that, he gained back 30 pounds. Why? Because he gave himself permission to have one cookie, one piece of cake, and then he's like off the rails for 3 months. And this is what happens. This is what we see clinically, too. The people who can stick with it are doing awesome. And he has mice studies that show that sugar is 7 times more addictive than cocaine, right? So you take a mice, who hook them on cocaine already. It's not even a fair study. And then you put them in and let them have sugar water or cocaine water. He goes to the sugar water. Crazy stuff, and we don't appreciate this enough. And there's a lot of data coming out. As a matter of fact, I just got a study that was sent to me. Back, the sugar guys have been really, they're like the cigarette guys. There's a lot of hidden research, and there's a lot of misdirection that we've all kind of fallen for. And again, studies show that the kids, you take away their soda, they flip out. They're searching places, they'll break into stuff. Good kids, but they want that soda. They're super addicted to the stuff. And prison studies show you put more sugar in the system, more violence happens. So is it crazy that there's a connection between addiction and mood and personality and all this? Because me as a doc, I saw a lot of people coming back saying, man, I just feel good. I don't feel stressed. I feel like when I see stuff, it's like I just ate. You don't want to go eat again, even though you go, that looks good, but I don't want it anymore. And that's kind of what we're seeing. And kids who drink soda are 60% more likely to be obese and are more violent. They have more problems in school, more attention deficit. All these kids are medicated, and we say, oh, it must be because of the video games. It must be because of this. It must be because they're not exercising. Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with this. And I don't know if you guys saw that. Just recently, some lady went to the restaurant. They didn't have her shakes that she wanted. She goes to her car, gets a baseball bat, breaks out all the windows and doors of the place because she's mad they don't have a shake. It's like, is that addiction? What the heck is that, right? So, and this is another study that they did, and overall, it's the same thing. You're just going to hear this over and over. It's not only a substitute to addictive stuff like cocaine, but it's more rewarding and attractive, and it's socially acceptable, right? So we can do those kind of things. And again, more robust, all those kind of things. And it's a survival thing. Our body tells us, hey, sugar, and, you know, because the bears, they'll eat berries, they eat all this sugary stuff before the winter. They put on a bunch of fat so that they could hibernate, right? So what do we do now? We have sugar all year round. It's not like we have it just for a short period. Like in California, if you just ate the fruit that was from here, it wouldn't be all year round like we're doing now. And so we had two people actually, they got full-blown diabetes, my patients, I watched the whole thing happen, juice fast, both of them full-blown diabetes with majorly elevated 3-month sugar average. They cut their carbs, they did all this stuff, now they're off all meds and their sugars are normal. It's incredible. Because we think fruit is so good for us, but when you do it in excess, it's a problem. So this came up in our discussion. This is something that's really interesting to me. I never even knew this. But during this course of our discussion, after a gastric bypass for morbidly obese people, look at the divorce rate. 75 to 85% at 2 years, 90% at 5 years. Like, that's a recipe for divorce. Now, it's not going to be dietary related necessarily. I mean, obviously when you weigh 500 pounds, there's some dysfunction that happened at the beginning to get you to that stage, right? Unless you deal with the underlying physiology, you're gonna be in trouble the whole time. Interesting, Tro brought this up. He said, look, Brian, these guys have increased alcohol, smoking, shopping, pornography, extramarital affairs, depression, suicide after a bypass. You would think they're losing weight, they're feeling better about themselves. All those things should get better. They shouldn't wanna have to drink and all that stuff. Why? Why? Again, it's because we took away their drug of choice. Now they can't go when they're stressed out, when someone's mean to them. They can't go eat a bunch of bonbons and sugar and cake and all that stuff because they have no stomach to put it in anymore. So now they figure out ways to get around that system until they figure out, why am I so stressed and why am I eating to calm my nerves, right? And this is how this whole addiction stuff, because again, going back, there's dysfunction to start with. Sometimes the person wants the wife to be obese or the husband to be obese so that they don't leave them, so that they stay with them. And then this dysfunction is never fixed. So what's the underlying problem? I have yet to meet a patient who struggles with alcohol, drugs, and all these things that don't have underlying anxiety, stress, and depression. They're self-medicating. That's what we're doing. So whether we choose food, whether we choose pornography, whether we choose these things. And that's why in the church, I was talking to some of the guys last night, and they said it's like 68% of the church is struggling with pornography. Right? And it's not just men anymore. Women, it's become a huge thing. Why? Because that's their escape. You have Facebook, you have Twitter, you have all these things where we can escape reality for a little while and just kind of shut down. And that's what we're dealing with. This is, as a society, what we're dealing with. So processed food, this is the big one. Look, not everyone has to be keto, not everyone has to be low carb, not everyone, but you say, look, let's get rid of the processed food. Kevin Hall from the National Institute of Health, and he's not a keto guy, came out and said, look, processed foods, when people are eating processed foods, they eat 500 calories a day more than people who eat real food. They eat a real hamburger, a real steak. There's nothing radical about that, right? Eat real food, don't eat the processed stuff, don't eat the chips and crackers and the cereal and all that stuff. And this is incredible. Look at this. In South Pacific Islands, they had low consumption of Western foods. Schizophrenia rates, when they introduced this kind of food, processed food, 1 in 30,000 to 1 in 500. That is crazy numbers. I mean, that's just incredible. Like, could you imagine if a new drug came out that did that? Those guys would all be in jail and the drug would be off the market. There's no way they would allow this to happen. And it correlated with the grain, sugar, and alcohol intake, right? Increasing homicides, linoleic acid. There's a lot of talk coming out and you're gonna hear a lot more about seed oils. Like for me, I recommend my patients, look, olive oil, coconut oil, avocado oil. and olive oil, right, basically. And so staying away from some of these seeds, there's a lot of data coming out. You think, what do oils have to do with sugar and diabetes and stuff? There's a ton of data coming out, and it's overwhelming. And again, the same thing. You know, if you eat more sugar, you're going to have more problems, more depression, more anxiety, more of this stuff. So how does that fit? And we don't know. I don't know why the ketogenic diet or a low-carb diet works for seizure disorder. Is it because you're eating more fat? These guys eat a way more high fat than I would ever recommend, but it's stabilizing something in their brain. Is it that, or is it because you're taking away the carbohydrates? We don't know. We don't know the answer to it. But what we do know is they've done studies with inflammation, and this is interesting. The low-carb ketogenic diet is a low-inflammation diet, so people with rheumatoid arthritis get better. Osteoarthritis get better. Autoimmune problems like psoriasis get better. Why? Doesn't make sense. Is it because we're taking something away or we're giving something back that people need? And so when you start looking at the data, you think, wow, it's incredible. So they did a study, and they were looking at people that were on Celebrex. Does everyone know what that is? It's an anti-inflammatory medication. So people taking Celebrex had lower depression, anxiety, stress levels than people that weren't taking it. And they said, well, it's an anti-inflammatory. It has nothing to do with neurotransmitters in the brain. So it turns out that everyone thought, oh, it has to be that their pain is better, so they're less depressed. So they control for the pain level. You have a pain level 6, I have a pain level 6. You're on Celebrex, I'm not, people do better. Why? They started looking at, they do PET scans of the brain. Guess what? Decreased inflammation in the brain. They go, oh, maybe if we decrease inflammation in the brain, people do better. And these studies are showing the more sugar you're eating, the more inflammation you have in your brain, the more depression you have. The higher your sugars are, the more depressed you are if you're diabetic. The better control you have. And it may be that depressed people just don't take care of themselves, or it could be that the high sugars. But we're thinking more and more it's the high sugars that are causing the problem. Because when we control the sugars, they do better, right? And again, with girls, the same thing. If they eat more fast food, processed food, they have way more depression than other people. This is crazy stuff. I didn't even know this until the other day. I was looking, I'm like, oh my gosh. And I've talked to a couple of docs to verify this. 95% of our serotonin is made in our gut, in our GI tract. Guess what knocks that down? Sugar, inflammation, right? So we're giving people medicines to raise their serotonin levels when if they just change their diet, they can control it without taking another drug, right? Because we're taking a drug to decrease the inflammation. We're taking a drug for this. So all of a sudden, you're on 12 drugs. And look at our, you know, I have patients, I look at their drug list and say, oh my gosh. Half these meds are for side effects from the other medicine that you're taking that you don't even need anymore if you change your lifestyle and exercise and activity and all this kind of stuff. So we haven't appreciated this. There's a ton of gut microbes. We don't understand it all. I mean, we're at the infancy, but we're seeing there is an impact somehow. Leaky gut, people will talk about. There's so many things that we're seeing that we're at the infancy of this science, and it's going to take a long time to understand. But this is super interesting to me, that sugar reduces brain-derived neurotrophic factor. What is that important for? Low level associated with depression, schizophrenia, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. We have an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease. You can go look online, just Google it, type 3 diabetes, what pops up? Alzheimer's disease, dementia. We get insulin resistance in our brain, we can't get the sugar into our brain to function properly, and we can't function properly, we get demented. This is where I think the low-carb ketogenic diet is really gonna help a lot of people. Because to say, well, it controls seizure disorder, we have data. I mean, this is not like just saying that. This is we see that clinically. Can we help depression, anxiety, Alzheimer's disease? Can we prevent it from us? Yeah, I think so. And this may be one of the things where you'll hear something about exogenous ketones, where people take ketones. And this may be something else, because when someone's 85-year-old and they're demented, you're not gonna change their diet. They're gonna be in a nursing home and they get all this terrible food. So that may be something. Again, 30% increase in inflammation in the brain. JAMA, this is one of our main journals. So we're seeing it, then we say, well, inflammation in the brain's a problem. We gotta find a new drug to decrease the inflammation. Guess what? You want a ketogenic diet, low carb diet, you decrease the inflammation in your brain almost instantly. So people's mood and depression, I was seeing this clinically and I thought, this is weird. Why is their mood better? I don't know why. They haven't lost that much weight. I see people control their sugars without losing a bunch of weight because they're burning off fat around their liver, and I'll talk a little bit about that if we have time. So Carnivore Cruz, that's the guy who tweeted back to me. And I saw him, I tweeted him, I said, you know, I would really like to talk to you. Do you have the courage to go public with what you're talking about? Because this is really important for guys, especially in church. So he said, yeah, Brian, no problem, I'll come on. So he comes on. If you have a chance, if you struggle with anything or know someone who is, listen to this. I think episode number 10 and episode number 13 were like a God thing, right? Because they feed hand in hand. I had to accept to say, is there such thing as a food addiction? Is that true? Yeah, it is. And I'll explain the physiology a little bit. I don't want to bore you guys with too much science, but if you want to hear it, I'd love to tell you about it. This guy's dad was a worship leader. He was abusive, alcoholic. So the kid would go in his room, and how did he escape? Cookies, cereal, high-carb stuff. Pizza with a bunch of cheese on it. So the guy balloons up. He has a 48-inch waist. He's 5'6", and he turned to food. And then he wants to do the school play. The guy goes, look, you're 400 pounds. We can't have Romeo being 400 pounds. No one's going to buy that. You're a great guy. You're a good actor, but you cannot do it. So he goes on, and he diet, exercise, kills himself trying to get down there. He loses weight, does the school play, happy, turns to pornography, and he tells his whole story. Like, to hear this guy, this is a smart guy. This is not some crazy guy that you think, like, is sitting in his mom's basement looking at pornography. So he turned to pornography to deal with his stress after that because he thought, yeah, this is a better outlet. And he thought, as a Christian, he was struggling. He felt guilty and bad and terrible. And all. It's the same thing. It's the same thing as an obese person who all of a sudden goes on a binger. And I just had a consult with a guy. He quit meth, quit cocaine, quit pornography, and guess what? He struggles with food. His daughter leaves, and he'll go to 5 different restaurants and get food and eat it all while she's gone. It's a total disaster, right? But this guy, meth is probably the most addictive substance on earth. He got off that, and he can't give up the food addiction, right? Because it's socially acceptable, and he could get away with it. But it's still self-destructive. Why is he doing that? Neurotransmitters. The more drugs we've taken, the more alcohol we've had, the more carbs we've had, you burn off that dopamine in your brain. The receptors down-regulate. That's why coming off cocaine is so hard, because when you're taking it, you feel great. You're on top of the world. Everything's good. Then you take away that stimulus. Now you don't have as many receptors. And guess what? You feel like garbage for a year. That's why he's like, oh, I've been feeling terrible for 8 months. That's it. I'm going back. They use cocaine. They feel great again. They burn off their neurotransmitters more. And then you get into that cycle more and more. The same thing happens with carbohydrates. I see it with my patients. They'll be doing great, then the holidays come, they gain 15 pounds, and they're like, oh, my sugar's out of control, my blood pressure's back up, and I got all this stuff. But then they realize, okay, let me get back on track, and they get back on track, and they know they felt better, and they're doing better, and their mood, anxiety, stress, all that gets better. It's the same thing. I have patients who come in, and they're on a ton of Xanax. Does anyone know what that is? That's a very addictive anxiety medicine. So they come in, they're on, I go, yeah, it's not good long term. Let's put you on something like Lexapro, an antidepressant that raises those serotonin levels. Again, we're talking about the gut stuff with serotonin. So if I'm trying to raise your serotonin levels, if I decrease the sugar in your gut, guess what? Your serotonin levels go up without having to take a drug. But you need it sometimes, and people aren't going to change their diet for whatever reason. So put them on Lexapro, and then 2 or 3 months later, I'll ask them, I'll go, hey, how much Xanax are you taking? I haven't taken it at all. Why not? I'm not stressed. Right? You take their stress away. So you take that sugar addiction away, people aren't as stressed, and they're not as depressed, so they're less likely to stress eat. They're less likely to do pornography stuff. So I didn't even finish, so let's get through the rest of the stuff. So he meets his wife, says, look, he goes, this isn't good dating advice, but I told her the first date, look, I got issues. I struggle with this, I struggle with food, I have obesity, then. And she goes, look, I got issues too, let's make this happen, right? So they get married, they have a great marriage, they're doing great. Then he's an engineer, super smart guy, turns to alcohol to calm his nerves. Right? Then he has one drink a week. Then he has 2 drinks a week. Then it's a drink every day. Now it's 4 drinks a night. And his wife goes, don't you think you had enough? He goes, ah, she's annoying me. You know, leave me alone. This is classic addiction behavior. Like, don't talk to me about it. I'm fine. I know what I'm doing. Us guys stuff, right? This is why it's important to talk to you guys about it, even though it's out of my comfort zone. Turns it to alcohol. So he's drinking. He gets a job promotion. He gets transferred to Detroit. So he's on his own. Us guys, the worst thing we could do is be on our own, right? He's on his own in Detroit. And he goes, you know, I've been gaining weight. I think I'm going to start doing a low-carb diet. Because as a matter of fact, I'm going to go super hardcore. This crazy guy who's up in Orange County, Sean Baker, he's carnivore. All he eats is meat. Why? Because he has addictions to carb stuff. So he goes, if I'm just eating meat, it's easy. It's not like I'm having fake cookies and all of a sudden I want the real thing, right? It's just the same mentality as if you have an alcohol problem but you drink O'Doul's every day. Sooner or later, you're going to go back to the same thing. But if you change over to iced tea, totally different. Your brain's not thinking along those lines anymore. And the amount of going back to it is way lower. So he moves to Detroit. He's on his own, can do his own thing. 3 weeks later, he's at the computer. He goes, it wasn't because my lifestyle has gotten better. I'm trying to sell a house, and he was from Oregon. He goes, we're trying to sell a house in Oregon. My wife has the kids. It's super tense. I'm starting a new job. I'm doing all this stuff. And he says, I haven't looked at, this is 3 weeks after you started a carnivore diet, which is a super low carb or a ketogenic diet. He said, I haven't had a drink, I haven't looked at pornography, and I haven't had a bunch of carbs since I've been doing this. He said, this is kind of a crazy thing. And so he was shocked, because this guy was going to Christian counseling, he had accountability, he was doing everything he was supposed to do, and I think this is the missing link for guys in pure desire. Because if we don't control our diet and our those kind of things, just saying I'm quitting, it's on your own willpower and strength, right? I mean, he goes, maybe God delivered me of it, but all of a sudden when he came on, we've had so many people contact us and go, same thing. Like, it's unbelievable how many people have done better. So now it's 2 years later, he's doing great. Crazy stuff. Maybe it's a coincidence, right? So we're not making any claims. I'm just saying, hey, look, this is something we have to look at. And for me, if I can do that and it helps, then it's a good thing. So these are tough associations. I just want to run through this. So cigarettes. People quit cigarettes. They're doing great. When do they stumble? They go, oh, I'm going to have a glass of wine. Right? And they remember, oh, man, I used to have wine with my buddies. And when I had a glass of wine, then I had cigarettes. And then they're smoking a cigarette, right, because of that. Or they say, you know, every morning I had a cup of coffee and a cigarette. That was my habit. So now coffee is that link back to having cigarettes again. So Rob Seifus, the bariatric surgeon I told you about, says, look, when you give your permission to have one drink or one thing, that is giving yourself, once you do that, then it's easy to do the second one. Especially if you're having alcohol, because you're going to say, well, you know, I've been doing so good so long. Because the logic is this. This is what's crazy, because if you look at it from an addiction standpoint, it makes zero sense that you would say, okay, I haven't had a drink all week, so I'm going to go out and party with my friends Friday night to celebrate that I haven't had a drink all week, right? But it's the same thing on a diet. You say, oh, I've been so good on my diet, I'm just going to blow it this week, and then guess what, you're off the road. But the important thing is knowing yourself. Some people can do that. I know friends who are ex-alcoholics, or you're never an ex-alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic, but they can have a drink and they'll tell their wife, look, give me one drink and that's it, I'm not going to have any more, and they're done. The other guy has one drink, goes, oh, shut up, I'm going to have what I want, and then he's drunk for a month, right, or 2 months, and totally goes off the rails. And so the other thing, okay, cigarettes, you quit cigarettes, what do? You have suckers, lollipops, candies, all this stuff, right? And then guess what, you look at the scale and go, oh my gosh, the average person who quit smoking gains 10 pounds, why? Nicotine may have some suppression of the appetite, but what we do is we're substituting other drugs. And I've seen it over and over. One of my patients, she's you look at her six-pack abs, cut, active, super fit, cross-training like 2 hours a day, just excessive stuff. But she comes in, she goes, hey, Brian, guess what? I go, yeah. She goes, I gained weight. I go, you gained like 4 pounds, big deal. She goes, guess what? I'm drinking, I'm smoking, I'm drinking a six-pack at night, and I'm smoking. I'm like, what happened? She was like green drink and like super healthy, like, you know, eating nothing processed at all. And she said, you know, my mom and my dad died, and I thought, you know, I'm excessive on my exercise. Then I had to go work at their house, and I was stressed at night, so I had a drink. And then I said, you know, I felt like having a smoke, because when I used to drink, I would have a cigarette. And then she went into this whole bad cycle. Now, guess what? She's back. She straightened her life out. She goes, oh, my gosh, I feel so much better. She's working out at a reasonable rate, and she's watching what she's eating. And she quit smoking and drinking and all that stuff. So what are better tools? Look, stress. This is what docs, we don't have time. Like, you know, the problem with medicine right now, you have 7 minutes with a patient a lot of times, you have 15 minutes. You can't say, well, how's life stress? How's this? How's that? Right? You say, oh, your blood pressure's high? Okay, here, take this drug. Your sugar's high? Here, take this drug. Instead of saying, why is your sugar high? Why? We don't step back and do what we're supposed to do. The people changing medicine right now are the engineers. They're coming and go, wait, guys, this doesn't make sense. They don't have a deficiency of a blood pressure hormone or something. I mean, it's because the underlying cause. They've gained 50 pounds and their sugars are out of control and insulin's out of control. And it's, you know, Rob Seifus says, look, get a bridge. If you're snacking all day, you don't need to snack all day. Our human body, God created us in a way where we can survive for long periods of time without eating. But in our society, like I told people for a long time, never skip breakfast, eat 5 times a day. Eat snacks, keep your metabolism going. No data to support that. Zero. Nothing. Right? And we tell people that all the time because someone told us that and we told that. So the engineers come and go, wait, guys, that doesn't make sense. How come these aborigines, these guys eat one meal every 3 days and they're doing fine? They're not having heart disease, strokes, and all the stuff that we're having. And why do we're getting fatter when we're eating 5 times a day. Shouldn't we look at that? You know, Jennifer has some great guys. You see where our obesity rate was like this and diabetes, and then all of a sudden they give us the new food pyramid and it goes like this. It's the only thing that changed. People listen, and us docs think, no one's listening to us and they're getting fat because they're not listening. No, they're listening, but we're giving them bad advice, and that's the problem. So distracting yourself, like Rob Seifus says, look, have coffee, have tea, have something. And he says, because he's an addict to carbs, he goes, my house has zero carbs. Like, if I'm hungry in the middle of the night, I look and I have a bunch of options, but nothing has carbs there, right? Because he knows if he has one, his brain goes back there and he wants more and more. It's just like, you know, that's where addiction comes in. Like, when we were kids, we didn't have all the stuff we have now. We had Playboy, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, someone's dad has Playboy, right? It was like that. Now all of a sudden, it's like this radical stuff. It gets more and more radical, just like anything. We call them gateway drugs because you have that. No one starts out on methamphetamine. I've never met one person who said, yeah, I just started methamphetamine, right? No one starts that way. They say, well, I have pot every once in a while, then I have alcohol, and then that wasn't enough, so then I start. So then we keep going down that road, and that's exactly what we're doing as a society. And that's the thing. Stay busy. know, and that's the thing is, our society, and especially as Christians, this is like preaching to the choir a bit, but it's the same thing I feel with keto. There's a lot of some people, yeah, I'm keto, but then I eat ice cream and cake and all this stuff at night. And us guys are Christian during the day, and then we go home, and like wife goes to sleep, and you're up till 2 in the morning looking at pornography because that's the only time you could do it, or when they're not home. That's time you're taking away from your employer. It's time you're taking away from your wife. Trust issues. I've seen marriages totally get destroyed by pornography, by alcohol, by drugs, because the guy has drugs hidden in his car. He has alcohol hidden there, and she's like, wait, we're supposed to be partners in this, right? It's integrity, right? That's what it comes down to. But when you're addicted, all that goes out the window, right? Because you need that addiction, and you don't care. Everything else, you give it up. That's by definition addiction, right? Like, we give up stuff that's important to us to go do that thing, whether it's football that you have to watch every single game and your wife wants to show you her new outfit and you're like, get out of the way, I'm watching football, right? All those things that we use as a substitute, our escape for our brain from a stressful life. So stay busy, find a hobby, all that kind of stuff, and then deal with the underlying stress. Simplify your life. Look, tell people you can't help them move when you only have a couple hours off, or you know, say, I can't do these things and at work that are over the top type stuff. And these things, when your stress gets better, guess what? All these addiction stuff gets better. Because we're medicating our stress with that stuff. And so help others, have accountability, prayer and fasting. I mean, there's tons of data out there. And it's really interesting. I mean, why are we called to pray and fast? Like, you know, you see stuff in the Bible where they say, look, these demons can't be cast out except for prayer and fasting. Why? And this is what, in the church where we've done some crazy stuff. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But knowing your triggers, you know, a good friend of mine, we were out at a medical conference and you know, I've been trying to mentor him. He's a really good guy, and he's talking to girls at the bar. I'm like, dude, it's not a good idea. Don't go down there. He's like, oh, I'll be down there for a few minutes. Don't do it, because you're playing with fire. You're playing with fire. Go back to your room. Stay away from that, right? So it's hard, because the more you play with fire, because you say, oh, I have an addiction to carbs, but I'm just going to have one donut today. Guess what? You're going to have donuts for the next month. That's the way it is, if you're that person. So people can do it and say, okay, I'm done. I feel terrible. I'm going back. But I can't tell if you're that person. Only you know if you're that person or not, if you can have one drink every once in a while. The person who wrote the book on alcoholics drinking in moderation died in a wrong way accident drunk, right? Because she clearly wasn't that person. So these things, living according to the flesh, because when you focus your mind on God, you focus your mind on what's important, your family. Because the other thing, and I don't, I'm blanking on his name. They're talking about his own struggles with pornography in his marriage. Mike Slater from the unbelievable. And that guy's story was unbelievable. He has a beautiful wife, and she wasn't enough because the pornography, because it was all like everyone's perfect, and you know, they don't wake up with bad hair in the morning and all that kind of stuff. It's an unrealistic expectation. So we live our life expecting that. We don't appreciate what we have, and we go down the wrong path. And this is where the church, if I could help the church in one way with its ketogenic low-carb stuff, it's this. Because fasting is not an act of sacrifice, because we think that we're like, God, I'm giving up food for you. Okay, now I want the new car, I want the new job, I want all this new stuff, right? Because I'm sacrificing for you and I'm struggling, I'm suffering. The reason we're suffering is because we're sugar dependent. So if the church says, look, we're going to do a fast, let's go low carb for a week before they fast, it's going to be cakewalk, easy, right? Like, I haven't eaten today. I worked out, they saw, I have a witness in the back. We worked out with Jeff Carterman at his gym. Super, I've had zero carbs. Do I need carbs? No, I have fat tissue that can break down, and I'll explain the physiology just for a second. But it's not about sacrifice. It's freeing you from the distraction, saying, what am I going to eat an hour? What am I going to do? When you're dependent on that, you're a slave to food, basically. We become slaves to food, because every 2 hours we have to have chips and crackers and all this stuff. Because I'll explain a little bit about that. And then wake up, count your blessing, do your devos, do stuff that gets you on the right path. Put on your armor. Understand you're going into battle every single day, right? You want to have a clear brain going into battle. That's why you think about these guys. Like, if food gave us, Jason Fung, who's a good friend of mine now, he does the podcast with us also. He's talking about fasting. I thought this guy was nuts. Why would you fast when there's so much good food out there? Just eat healthy stuff. Eat in moderation. Do the right stuff. But he has tons of data. There's something called autophagy, where you start breaking down bad cells that cause dementia and plaques in your brain and all this kind of stuff. But mental clarity. I'm telling you, I know a lot of people, they go, look, if I'm giving a big talk, maybe I'm not as mentally clear as them. But in a fasting state, you're more mentally clear. You think better. Because everyone thinks food gives you energy. Everyone at Thanksgiving, I guarantee you, was sitting there holding their stomach going, oh, God, I'm tired. No one's playing football after Thanksgiving dinner, right? But people who don't eat that, you don't get that food coma. If you're not eating high-carb stuff, you're not getting food coma. It ain't happening, right? Because you're not getting those hormones going crazy up and down. Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys. And I just want to explain to you what I'm talking about from this, because it's really hard, a ketogenic diet. The point is this. The physiology is, when we see someone who's morbidly obese, we look at him and go, how can that guy be hungry all the time? Look how much fat he's carrying. That's our energy storage. How can he be hungry all the time? It doesn't make sense. But when you understand, insulin. Insulin is our hormone for storing fat. So if you're 300 pounds, I 100% guarantee you, your insulin level is going to be high. Even if your sugar's high, I say, well, insulin gets rid of it. So insulin's job is this, for anyone that doesn't understand. Insulin, when you eat sugar, your body says, oh, sugar's high, get rid of the insulin. In our bloodstream, we could have 1 teaspoon of sugar at a time in the bloodstream. So when it goes above that, your body says, oh, sugar's high, get rid of it. It can't be there because we know it's toxic. The first thing we metabolize is alcohol, that's a toxin. Second thing, sugar, right? So fat could float around, there's not causing a problem. So grabs the sugar and says, okay, where do I put it? Since I worked out with Jeff Carterman today, my glycogen stores were depleted, right? So my sugar goes there. Big deal. Okay, good. Now, I eat more and more sugar today. My body says, okay, now the muscle's full now. Where do I put it? Liver. Fat stores, right? And then, so insulin's up. It does all that stuff. So let me give you an example so it makes sense. I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. It's not quite this simple, but it pretty much is. Tonight we go home and we have Coke and a donut and cereal before going to bed. Sugar's high. Sugar's high, your body says spike the insulin. Insulin's high. Insulin starts grabbing that sugar, storing away, you know, you're using it for your heart, brain, all that kind of stuff. So at 2 a.m, your sugars start coming down. So your body says, oh, sugar's starting to get lower. Maybe I start kicking up this counter hormone, like the biceps and tricep, glucagon. Glucagon raises blood sugar. It does the exact opposite of insulin. So your sugar level starts coming down. Your body says, oh, sugar's getting a little low. We better keep an eye on this. Then you wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to have orange juice and cereal, like they tell us in the American Diabetes Association diet, which is totally wrong. Insulin level goes back up. Then 2 hours later, your sugar starts getting low. I'm going to have a snack. Insulin level's high. So insulin level is chronically elevated, which increases inflammation, increases cardiovascular risk. So the counterpart of that, so you never get to use your glucagon. Your fat stores, you can never get to it. If you're morbidly obese, the problem is this. You can never get to that because your insulin's always high. Even if your sugar goes low, your insulin stays high. So your body says, uh-oh, I can't get to my own fat stores because my insulin's too, if it's over 15, it's super hard to get it back down to that level. So what does it do? Makes you eat. You have to eat. There's no you have no choice because you can't get to your own fat stores. Now, let me explain the other side of the coin. Say you go tonight and you go home and go, okay, I'm going to have steak and salad, or I'm going to have salmon and whatever, not have the rice, not have the bread, not have the pasta. Your sugar doesn't spike. Your sugar stays the same. So while you're sleeping at night, your body says, uh-oh, my sugar's starting to drop. So it says, glucagon, get up and do your thing. So glucagon goes up and says, okay, fat stores from the liver, you know, in the liver from the sugar that you ate today, the yum-yum donuts or whatever we had here, breaks that bound and the sugar, and it keeps your sugars balanced because it's doing the counter-regulatory, right? So now your glucagon goes up. You wake up in the morning, you say, you know what? I'm going to fast until noon. That whole time, glucagon has to get sugar from somewhere. It's your fat stores. It's breaking that down and using it as an energy source. Your body doesn't care if the energy is coming from your liver fat or from eating carbs all day, right? So now these high-endurance athletes are running on a low-carb diet because they can run. They could do these things because they could live on their liver stores. Their body gets adept at doing that, but it takes a time to make that transition, being what we call fat-adapted, where you can run on your fat stores. So you're burning that off rather than being dependent on sugar all day long. So now they're fasting. Guess what? This goes up. People have mental clarity. They do fine. Their stomachs aren't hurting them because they can run on their own fat stores that we have. Unfortunately, I have more fat than I want to have, right? But you run on that, and you try to keep your body balanced. But when your body is spiking, no one, and this is important, with one exception I've ever seen, but no one gets low sugars from doing a low-carb diet because when you cut your sugars down, you're not spiking your insulin anymore. Right? You spike your insulin, your sugars go low. Then you get hungry again. Then you eat, sugars go up, insulin goes up to get rid of that, and overshoots, and shoot makes your sugars low. Now we're hungry all day long. And that's what's happening to us. And when we stabilize those hormones, guess what? The stress hormones get better. You're less stressed, you're less depressed, you're less anxious, you're less. So if you're a stress eater or depressed eater and all that stuff, because all these things that we know are associated with cardiovascular disease, what? Not exercising raises insulin. Stress raises insulin. Not sleeping raises insulin. Sugar raises insulin. All these things that raise insulin increase cardiovascular risk. And there's tons of data coming out on this. And it's a stress hormone. That's what it's doing. So the big problem we get into is if we keep eating sugar, what happens is your pancreas that makes insulin says, I'm done, your sugar's 300, I can't keep up. Plus high sugar is toxic to the pancreas. So like I said, when the insulin's high, it suppresses glucagon. Now what happens is you lose your insulin. Your sugar's 300. You can't make insulin anymore. Your body's given up. It's like leaving the refrigerator door open all night. It can't run like that for that much time. So now what? Glucagon. You take the brakes off glucagon. What does glucagon do? Pumps sugar back into the bloodstream. So now you have sugars of 300. You've taken the brakes off, and all that is going into the bloodstream. Now your sugar's 500. You're in the hospital with an IV trying to save your life. You need insulin to bring your sugars back down. So our point is, let's prevent it before it happens, right? We have to look at that and understand the physiology. So hopefully that makes sense. And all this does tie together with the depression, anxiety, drugs, whatever addiction you're struggling with. It makes a difference. It really does. And we're seeing that clinically. So, hey, Jim's got to come up next. You guys have any questions, anything not clear that, yeah, I would love to answer.
So you said there was two kinds of food. You thought carbs was one of them. There was protein and...
Yeah, he was saying protein and fat are the foods. Protein. Carbs and addiction, right? It's a drug. Because the point is, look, alcohol, no one needs alcohol. You can survive your whole life without alcohol. And he's making the same point. Because if there's something that... What he's saying is, look, if you have a bad relationship with something, like if you're beating your wife, it's not saying, oh, we'll just get together 2 days a week then because I'm beating my... No, when you don't have control over a relationship, you get out of that relationship, right? Some people have control of it. It's not... Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying carbs are the devil and the enemy. If you're a fit, metabolically active person, 12% of us are, then we're good, right? But that's only 12%. What about the other 88% of us? We're making dietary guidelines based on 12% of the population. Doesn't make any sense. The rest of us need to get healthier to get to that point, right? So, yeah. Anyone else? Good. Thanks for sticking with me, guys. Appreciate. Oh, yeah.
When you're old and you've been doing the wrong thing for a long time and you start doing the right thing, does that make up for it, or is there still damage that won't be?
Well, I think there's damage that's done when you look at it. I was just at a medical conference, and three different cardiologists said the same thing. LDL is not necessarily the problem. It's the oxidized LDL. What oxidizes the LDL? Sugar, insulin. So if you have high insulin, and there's a study that just came out of Columbia, the biggest risk factor for the first cardiovascular event, high insulin levels. Again, stress, carbs, all this stuff we're doing. Most likely time to have a heart attack, Christmas Eve. You're stressed, you're not exercising, you're tense, you gotta deal with family like Jim, and all that stuff, and you got all that stuff, you got the perfect storm. And so they're thinking it's that flux of insulin going up and down like we're doing right now that breaks those plaques loose. There's guys in Africa that eat meat, all they eat is meat, blood, and milk. Zero cardiovascular disease. They're not dying of heart attack strokes. But when they do autopsies on them, they have atherosclerosis still. But they're not dying of heart attacks. It's not breaking loose and causing a problem. Because atherosclerosis itself sitting there is not a problem. But when it breaks loose, then you're in trouble. That's where statin drugs stabilize those things and keep it better. But the thing is, I think the damage is done, but you can reverse that damage. Those guys are reversing their disease process by decreasing inflammation, decreasing that insulin level, those fluxes that are going up and down doing crazy stuff. So people are feeling better. Their moods get all that. It's a whole spectrum of things, right?
So you're saying that you can reduce the damage.
Absolutely. Rob Sives, and I don't want to cut into Jim, but Rob Sives, that surgeon I told you about, we're at a conference with some great doctors. And he says, I don't do surgery on people with fatty liver disease. I go, you're a bariatric surgeon? Every single person you see has fatty liver disease. He goes, yeah. We cure them first, and then we do surgery. And everyone laughed, cussed at him, and said, come on, man. They said, how long does that take? 1 week. He said, probably less than that, but we have studies, and he showed me. By all of us, he showed 15 doctors, pre-fatty liver disease, biopsy, and ultrasound. Fatty liver disease, 1 week later, cured. What do you do? High-fat, low-carb diet. He took away their sugar because fatty liver disease comes from too much sugar. Sugar stores fat in the liver. Fat stores this fat out here. Sugar, high-fructose corn syrup, all the stuff that we're giving people, stores in the liver. Fatty liver disease is the precursor to diabetes, and that's what we're talking about. You get rid of the fatty liver. I've had people lose 5 pounds and resolve their diabetes. With 5 pounds. They're not losing 80 pounds and resolving it, right? So people are saying, look, you get gastric bypass, diabetes goes away, at least temporarily. And they think it's because you have to fast for 3 days to get the stupid surgery. So people who fast for any other surgery, their sugars get better. It's duh. You don't put sugar in the system, the sugar doesn't go up, right? So that's kind of that's kind of what we're seeing. But to cure fatty liver disease, as a matter of fact, as we speak, I believe now it's become the number one cause of cirrhosis in the world, passing alcohol. Crazy stuff. Yeah. I have 9 guys in my practice who are skinny that have type 2 diabetes. I was just in Guatemala. I saw at least 15 guys with type 2 diabetes that weigh less than 160 pounds. It's crazy stuff. I mean, because it's not about... The reason fat people get diabetes is you run out of places to store the sugar. You take the sugar, you store it here. You run out of fat stores. Some people run out of fat stores at 140 pounds. I've seen it. And it's crazy. It's not about being fat. It's that we run out. It's like if you have a storage unit, you run out of storage unit, where does your garbage go? At some place it overflows into the street. Then you see it. You go, oh my gosh. So diabetes is a spectrum. We're going to change the definitions of diabetes. Because once you're metabolically unhealthy, metabolic syndrome is what's causing the cardiovascular disease. We know that. That's the number one risk factor. High insulin level, high triglycerides, low HDL, right? Those are huge factors for us. So, yeah, you're right. You don't have to be fat to have type 2 diabetes, right? Yeah, we're seeing that.
So, just popped into my head, low carb thing, how does that help for us men? How does that help with the prostate stuff? Is there any relationship there?
I've not heard any correlation other than there are studies showing that decreased inflammation, decreased carbohydrates, sugar feeds cancer cells. Now, this isn't universal, but the more sugar you eat, the more insulin-like growth factor you get, the more likely you are to have cancers. So there's a lot of people saying, look, if you're going through, as a matter of fact, my wife's good friend, she since passed, but when she went through chemotherapy, she went on a low-carb diet, and she went through chemotherapy with, her doctor didn't believe it. He said, there's no way that you're not, because you're focusing all that when we look for a PET scan, what do? We starve you for a day, and we inject sugar into your veins that's tagged, and it goes right to the cancer cells, right? That's how we see the cancer cells on a PET scan. That's how it works. So when they're running out of ketogen, your cells can run on ketones. So if they're running on ketones, the cancer cells are dumb and can't run on ketones. They have to run on sugar. So it's all going to, right? So if you want to starve it as much as you can, but you're going to maintain a certain sugar level for survival, right? But the lower it is, the better off. Diabetics, obese people get more cancers, more strokes, more all this stuff, everything, right? Across the board. So I got to get out of here. We'll let Jim talk. But yeah, if you guys have any questions after, I'll be hanging out outside. Thank you, guys.